Today is March 14th, and I'm back with Carlos Moraes in his office at Miami University for the second day of the Pew interview.
University of Miami.
University of Miami.
There's actually a Miami University in Ohio.
Oh, okay. University of Miami. Gotcha. There are a couple things I wanted to go back and kind of finish up from yesterday, and then we'll move into today's work. One of the things I didn't ask you yesterday was whether you had any religious training growing up.
My mother is Catholic. She would go to church, I guess, on Sundays. Maybe not every Sunday, but quite frequent. So were her parents. Mm-hmm. I guess maybe more her mother. My father's side was also Catholic, but my father never really cared much for religion, so he wouldn't go to church unless he had to, but he was pretty neutral in terms of what kind of education we got. Mm-hmm. So I guess he was okay that we would go to church. As far as I can remember, it was always a drag for me to be there. I just was waiting for the time that I could sit down or knee. You know, I hated to stand up.
Oh.
But that's all I can remember. It was really too long. I was not very religious, or my upbringing was not very religious. My mother was not very imposing on that. She has her beliefs, but she never imposed too much on us. When I was a little older, maybe, how old was I? Maybe 18. I became part of a group that one might call even a cult. Let's see, how can I describe it? The name was Pro-Life, or mm-hmm. Pro-Vida in Portuguese. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It was founded by a physician that initially there was a lot of emphasis just in doing, paranormal studies or, telekinesis mm-hmm. and things like that. And that's how I guess my mother got interested through a friend of hers, and then mm-hmm. we went. And they had courses. Mm-hmm. So it was interesting. There was a whole philosophy, you know, similar to Buddhist philosophy, mm-hmm. I would say. But there were also some kind of fun exercise of trying to do these telekinesis things that maybe it was all placebo effect, but we thought it worked.
You mean like bending spoons?
Well, we wouldn't get that far, but try uh-huh. to, you know, close your eyes and push people around, oh, uh-huh. that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But it developed. I don't know if as the course developed, that's the way it was supposed to do. But anyway, it became more and more philosophical as you advanced through the course. Mm-hmm. They also had some interesting exercises of breathing and trying to get your conscience into alpha waves so that you can experience different things. Mm-hmm. It's kind of weird stuff. So this was interesting. I mean, there were some breathing exercises that were very, very intense. Mm-hmm. So you really get completely high at the end. And that mm-hmm. was followed with music. So it was a trip. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, they tried to, the instructors tried to direct us to some kind of trips that I would not necessarily go into. I mean, not that they'll tell us what to see, but, if we were in alpha waves, I don't even remember the details, but maybe I could detach from my body a little bit, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But it became more and more philosophical. I became quite involved up to a point. The courses were paid, but they never really tried to extract money from us. It sounded like a legitimate mm-hmm. kind of exercise. And they also did a lot of donations to charity and things mm-hmm. like that, and mm-hmm. organized things like that. Mm-hmm. So it was a valid thing that was interesting. my brother also got involved at a certain level, my sister, my father completely skeptical. even he was convinced to do like the basic course, but he was completely against some of the premises. Like, for example, they would say, if you truly believe that you're going to have a parking lot in front of the movie theater, you'll find one. And my father thought that that was complete absurd, because if everybody would think like that, there wouldn't be enough parking spots. So he was always very sceptic and skeptical about this. With time, I guess, I lost interest mainly because they became a little bit too close. You know, they were stimulating too much of socializing inside the group.
Mm-hmm.
Not that they would say don't socialize outside, mm-hmm. but there was too much emphasis in doing things within the group.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that became a little annoying to me, so I just lost interest. My mother, my sister had already lost interest before that.
Mm-hmm.
And they are, I think, still very popular in São Paulo, and they grew tremendously. This guy that founded it, that was a physician called, I think it was Celso Charuri, something like that. I can spell for you later. He became kind of a god figure, mm-hmm. because he died very young,
mm-hmm.
When this, you know, this group was growing very fast.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so all kinds of things came out of that, that his energy was around and et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. When he was mm-hmm. going to die, people actually knew and blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
So there was that aura of God mm-hmm. that he got. And that became a little weird also.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the philosophy was not too weird. It was,
mm-hmm.
you know, as I said, very similar to Buddhism, and you know, respect life and do good things mm-hmm. will come back to you. So it's not a too crazy kind mm-hmm. of a cult, but I think it can be considered mm-hmm. a cult. There's another one in São Paulo that's quite, I don't know if big is the word, but it's called Rosa Cruz. That's Rosa is from the flower rose, and Cruz is cross. And I think this is an international thing. It's also like, it's almost like a Masonic kind of.
Mm-hmm.
And this Pro Vida was similar in many ways to Rosa Cruz in terms of the philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was as much into religion / philosophy that I got into. I also, during my 18s or 20s, I also read quite a lot of books from Carlos Castaneda. I don't know if you read, but his initial books, or I think his first book is in Portuguese was called Erva do Diabo. That's erva meaning herb, and diabo is devil. So he was basically describing experience with the peyote, that's the Mexican,
mm-hmm.
mescaline.
Mm-hmm.
But his other books became much more philosophical and less related to drugs,
mm-hmm.
But his experiences in Mexico with his mentor of his called Don Juan. So I had that interest in that kind of philosophy. But I guess the more scientific I got, the less philosophic I became. And I think in terms of religion, that's as far as you know, I went. Let's see, my mother, she still, you know, goes to church. She does things for charity for the church.
Mm-hmm.
And I try, you know, we have some discussions, but I never try to tell her that I don't believe in any of this. And my father, you know, I just realized that he really doesn't believe in any of it.
Mm-hmm. So you don't practice anything now?
No.
Okay. Because one of the interesting philosophical questions is whether God and science, or how God and science can coexist, if they can. Any thoughts on the subject?
Sure. Well, I mean, the definition of God is probably the key aspect of any kind of discussion related to God and something else. I'm sure one can define God in a non-traditional way. That's just, you know, nature forces making all this happen. But maybe most people consider God as being a non-random force. So I believe more of on a random force, you know, like evolution happening just because the way it works, by natural selection. So, you know, if I have to use a definition of God that the church uses, I would say that I don't believe in God. If I have to say that, you know, God is something that has a purpose, it can be whatever it is, but has a purpose, then maybe I also don't believe in God, because I believe on the randomness of how, you know, we develop as a planet and as human beings.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, even if you believe in God as something that has a purpose and started everything with a purpose, I still don't see why that would be incompatible with science. As, you know, you can believe that the purpose, you know, used the laws of nature to build whatever the purpose was. Yeah, I can't see how some religious people would deny, you know, basic knowledge that we have in evolution and life mm-hmm. science. So, you know, the ones that want to keep our religion alive, they better adapt, I think, to what we know, because mm-hmm. it's very clear, I think, mm-hmm. for most reasonable people how things happen.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you. Another thing that I didn't ask you about your childhood was whether you had these, here we call them extracurricular activities, like music lessons and art and that sort of
right.
thing.
I guess when I was a little kid, my parents would take me to, like, clubs, and I'll do things like judo
oh, uh-huh.
or some kind of exercise, but I lost interest very fast on those mm-hmm. things. When I was a little older, maybe 13 or 14, I started doing capoeira. That's a very interesting dance fight. It's really Brazilian. That starts with the slaves. I don't know if you've ever seen, but it's very nice to watch, because, you know, as a show, it's like a dance,
mm-hmm.
but it can be a pretty violent fight.
Mm-hmm.
And that was great exercise, a lot of fun. And I did it for a few years. There were some championships, but those are more less of a dance and more of a fight. And I guess they scared me a little bit. And after a couple of those, that, you know, I saw people getting hurt, and I had to really fight. That's something I don't like.
Mm-hmm.
I dropped out.
Mm-hmm.
I guess at about the same time, I was getting more interested in surfing.
Mm-hmm.
And that became, I guess, my main hobby for many, many years, maybe from 17 to the time I came to the United States. So almost everything I would do in my free time, I would travel and try to do some surfing. That was very cleansing for me, you know. If I was stressed out, to go into the water and
mm-hmm.
just fight the waves, it was just great. You know, with the lifestyle of a surfer, I did some related things, like I started playing guitar,
mm-hmm.
But I never got any formal training.
Mm-hmm.
So I just learned with friends and playing together. The harmonica also would play. What else in terms of extra curricular activities. I think that's it. In São Paulo, I really wouldn't do much.
Mm-hmm.
So my hobbies and my activities, yeah, were. Mm-hmm. So after I was 16 or 17, my parents didn't have much influence on mm-hmm. what kind of extracurricular activities mm-hmm. I'll have, and I just did whatever was fun for mm-hmm. me.
Now, you mentioned this beach you went to that was like 2.5 hours from São Paulo. But I can't picture where São Paulo is on the map. Are there closer beaches that you could get to when you were younger?
Yeah, São Paulo is in the southeast of Brazil. It's about 60 to 80 kilometers from the water, from the ocean.
Oh.
The closest town is called Santos. That's S-A-N-T-O-S. But that's a port city, quite busy and unattractive.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, when I start surfing, I would go to many different places. Maresias, I actually start going a little later mm-hmm. as a more constant thing during the weekends. But when I start surfing, I would travel to many different towns mm-hmm. on the coast,
mm-hmm.
all within, you know, between 2 to 5 hours from São Paulo.
Okay.
And some of these trips were really very adventurous because there were no paved roads and we had to drive mm-hmm. through the beaches or very muddy
mm-hmm.
roads
mm-hmm.
And very few people, as you can imagine, because of the conditions. So it was really a great time.
So at what age did you start driving?
I started driving at 18.
At 18.
But I started traveling with my brother uh-huh. and friends before I could drive.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, there were some interesting experiences also before I started going to Maresias.
Mm-hmm.
Maresias is in the city of São Sebastião that I already mm-hmm. mentioned to you, and that's north. It's closer to Rio de Janeiro State. I also used to travel south. And there is a town called Peruíbe, that's P-E-R-U-B, I'll fix it later.
Okay.
That's, it's south of São Paulo, and after that, it's completely undeveloped,
mm-hmm.
going south. No roads, no nothing, there's actually a national park there.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to do some trips there, that would drive to as far as we could south and then just take our surfboards and walk through trails in the jungle and, you know, have lots of mountains there. It's not flat like here in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to cross two groups of hills, I
mm-hmm.
say, to go, you know, two beaches away.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to go to this one. There were some fishermen living there, people that always lived there, and would stay with them. In very primitive conditions, but that's, you know, the spirit I was in at that age. I really want to get out of the city and mm-hmm. be in this place, even though I was devoured by mosquitoes. And but I would adapt. I would adapt relatively fast to that kind of lifestyle, and I mean, it was just fantastic to be in a place like that.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes would go even further. That we have, you know, some trips that we had to walk, like for 2 days, for example,
mm-hmm.
to get to some very isolated place. That was mm-hmm. just beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
So those are great adventures that, you know, surfing kind of allowed me to do, was
mm-hmm.
part of it, because,
mm-hmm.
you know, our goal was always to find some nice waves.
Mm-hmm.
But in the way, we would, you know, experience mm-hmm. everything else.
Sure, sure. Well, if it took 2 days to get there, these weren't weekend trips.
No, those were vacations or holidays that
right.
were like, you know, 5 days
right.
in a row.
Okay. Now, yesterday you said that there was an impact on your career of the fact that you did less studying and more traveling, but you didn't elaborate on that.
Yeah. Well, the impact I had, I think I mentioned it, is that it's not that I did more travel and less study. It's that the fact that I would go to that particular beach, that's how I met that friend of mine wanted to measure carnitine.
I see.
So that had a major impact in my career because that's what brought me to the States.
Okay.
And was completely, you know, circumstantial.
Yeah.
By chance.
Okay. I guess you said it and then you told the story later, right. So I didn't connect the two. Okay.
And that's how I met Julia also, so in my personal life.
Sure. The first time, when you went to New York, even though you traveled a lot, that was really the first time you were living away from home on a permanent basis, right?
Second time. The first was in Buenos Aires.
Oh, that's right. Okay. So, Buenos Aires is a big city as well, but what was it like, you know, landing in New York for you?
Right. Yeah, I was always very adventurous in this kind of thing, so mm-hmm. I was never scared of those kinds of challenges.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very exciting. Mm-hmm. You know, everything was new. I had been in New York already, but you know, that was a different setup now, and I remember that maybe the first day I went to the top of the building there, that there was a Columbia University, and I saw the Hudson River, the George Washington Bridge, and it was just very exciting to be there. And I was looking forward to, you know, whatever was going to come up.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, and as you said, you know, I had traveled quite a lot, so I did not have any problems mm-hmm. in adapting to a different mm-hmm. lifestyle. That was easy.
Well, in New York can be a little bit of a culture shock, though. I know, as I mentioned to you, I lived there, and I know that for me there were a few things that took some getting used to, like the fact that the superintendent of the building does nothing unless you bribe him. Were there any culture shocks for you, or was it pretty much...
Yeah, I mean, amazingly enough, maybe for someone coming out of São Paulo, it's less of a shock than coming from someplace in the United States.
Else. Okay.
Let's see. One of the things that always strike me as quite different here in the United States, that everything's about money.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, even though São Paulo is a big city, it's different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people do things sometimes just to exchange favors, or
mm-hmm.
Or you know, poor people would give you things for free. Here's particularly in New York, you know, it's all about money. Everybody was trying to make a living. Everything's very expensive, so I understand that. So that was a bit of a difference, but still, you know, it was not too hard to adapt. I was in the Columbia housing.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I didn't have to bribe the super, but I also didn't get much for, you know, we pay a lot for housing there and don't get much for
right.
it.
Right. Okay. A couple other things you mentioned yesterday.
Maybe that's why I never got anything done.
Maybe.
I didn't know I had to bribe the super.
Okay. Just a couple more things from yesterday, and then we'll move on. You mentioned that this Parati was a role model for you, and then you said that you had other role models besides him. Were you referring to the few people in New York, or is there someone else?
No, someone else.
Okay.
Yeah, that was someone I met more recently, about, 7 years ago. A year after I was here in Miami, I decided to start a project, and I needed to collaborate with a fellow known, I mean, his name is Alex Tsagolov. And he's at Columbia, but not at the same campus. He's at the main campus at Columbia, in the biological science department,
mm-hmm.
With the TZ. And he's quite unbelievable. He's probably 53, 55. He has been one of the most productive people in the field of mitochondrial genetics, working with yeast. Till now, he spends most of his time working on the bench. He has a relatively small group, but all the work that comes out from his lab is very significant, because he defines very basic genes and how they work. He has all these yeast mutants. And, I think NIH has recognized that. He has this so-called R37 grant. That's like an outstanding scientist that I don't know exactly how they renew it, but I'm sure it's almost like automatic for someone like him. By the way, David Clayton also had one of those. Mm-hmm. So I went there and I spent 2 to 3 weeks in his lab trying to start that project. He came from Russia a long, long time ago. I was just very impressed with his, again, sharp sense of humor, strange at times. But the way that, he was always working in the lab, mm-hmm. at that stage in his career. I find this thing so hard to do that I admire people that can manage to do so. And I'm finding it harder and harder mm-hmm. here, and I'm much younger than mm-hmm. he is.
Okay, well, we're going to go into that right. in depth. Okay, the last thing I want to ask you was, you made a very brief allusion to being in some kind of trouble with the Brazilian government. Mm-hmm. Was that over immigration? No.
Actually, it was not. I could be because of my... I could have been because I got a PhD fellowship before being officially accepted to one. Mm-hmm. But I think I remediated that by being accepted to a program eventually. So, but yeah, I did not do things in the right way to start with. But that's the extent of mm-hmm. those potential problems. No, the visa, I never had a problem with it. Okay. I don't know if you want to discuss about it later, how I change my visas and how.
Actually, maybe this is a good time, but hold on 1 second. Okay, we're back on tape. Hey, why don't you go ahead and tell me? Because that's of great interest to people who are trying to emigrate to the United States.
Yeah. Well, I came with a J-1 visa. That's the exchange scholar. Some students can come with that also. Excuse me. And I had a J-1, so I did my PhD with a J-1. Mm-hmm. And then when I came to Miami to be hired as a faculty member, I needed a green card. Mm-hmm. And I applied by myself to a green card using this outstanding researcher mechanism. That's a straightforward, fast-acting mechanism that they have. And you really do not have to be any... Einstein to get it. And it worked very fast. I mean, I just put a dossier together and they ask you to just demonstrate that your work has been quoted by others. You've done some important things. You have letters from different people from different countries saying how great you are. And, just put the dossier together, and about a week or two they approved it. So it's really a very fast mechanism. So I had a green card for, I think, 5 years. And last year, I decided to become a citizen. I can keep my Brazilian citizenship, so I have both.
Dual.
Yeah. And the reason I decided to is because there are some strange laws here that do not give too much rights to green card holders. For example, not that I'm going to shoplift, but if I'm accused... of mm-hmm. shoplifting. I could be deported without trial.
Oh, I didn't know
And,
that.
Any other petty crimes like that, even if mm-hmm. they were committed 10 years ago, they could be grounds for deportation without a trial. Mm. So you, as a permanent resident, you really don't have all the rights that the citizens have. Mm-hmm. So I thought it was a good idea to get it.
Plus, you probably wanted to vote here in the Florida election for
yes,
president.
Yes, I did vote. probably my vote went to Pat Buchanan. But I try to do my best.
Okay. You know, about 2 years ago, maybe not quite that long, it was actually an article. I'm trying to remember if I saw it in Science or Nature. I think it was in Science. About the influx of foreign scholars and whether this was good or bad for American science. So, being one of them, what do you think about that?
Yeah, that's an ongoing debate, I think. Mm-hmm. In favor of allowing scholars to come, I think, is the shortage of people here. I have a lot of trouble hiring postdoctoral fellows, for example. And if I can get a good one, almost certain they're going to be foreign. Mm. So there are not many applicants that come from the United States. So sure, some of the top positions, you know, will be taken. There will be more competition for American citizens. But I think there is a demand for it right now. Mm-hmm. And until, you know, and the competition is one of the hallmarks of why the American system works well. So curbing competition might not be necessarily good. And so that's my view, that, you know, just keep it open as the United States keeps everything open, and it works. Mm-hmm. And it's a pity that not more Americans are going to science, for example. I think there's a real shortage, and I talked to my colleagues, and unless, you know, you're running a big lab at Harvard or Stanford, it's really very hard to get good American postdoctoral fellows. Students, you know, it's easier to get, but even students, I'm in the steering committee for a graduate program here, and the best candidates are foreigners. Mm-hmm. So also at that level, there are not many Americans that are willing to go into a science career, maybe because of all the pressures involved in it. The uncertainty about funding, and I'm sure we're going to talk more about that, and the low pace relatively to other jobs. Maybe now with the market downturn, this will change. We'll see that you know, it's not so easy to make money.
Mm-hmm. Well, in academics, but biotech these days, it's easier to make money.
It was, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it is. It's still risky, but I think we see more Americans going through those channels. Mm-hmm. Just because, yeah, maybe it's riskier, but it's much better pay. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, Americans have a need of quick satisfaction, so.
Instant gratification.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's talk about being a PI then. Okay, so there are many things you do, and I kind of want to go through them one at a time. And actually, since you talked about the money situation, let's start there with the chase for money, which mostly involves grant writing.
Okay. I am in a clinical department of neurology. Mm-hmm. And that poses one extra problem. That's mm-hmm. the lack of institutional support for my salary. So I'm expected to bring all my salary from grants.
100% soft money.
100%, right. If you are in a basic department here, I think they'll pay, you know, between 50 and 70%. They expect you to bring as much as you can, but mm-hmm. they'll still pay at least half of mm-hmm. your salary. Mm-hmm. Not only that, but basic departments have a better infrastructure, shared equipments and things like that.
Hold on for just a sec. Okay, we're back.
So one, I had to deal with these issues. Mm-hmm. So with the second issue, early on I tried to associate myself with the basic departments here mm-hmm. and make as many friends as I can and get involved into graduate programs and things mm-hmm. like that. And that has helped me, you know, in terms of recognition by colleagues that do the best science here. In terms of salary support, I had to go and get NIH funds. And I have been very lucky, I think, with NIH because, you know, from my first application for an R01, I got funded. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, I could have gone to the R29s. Those mm-hmm. were beginner's mm-hmm. grants. But they're judged very similarly to R01s that are more for established investigators. As much that they eliminate nowadays R29s. So you just apply to these grants mm-hmm. called R1 that are research grants. So I got funded by the National Eye Institute, I think after less than a year that I came here. So I had a little startup. I had my salary guaranteed for a couple of years, mm-hmm. plus a technician. So I got it funded by that, and I think the same year I got funded by the Muscular Dystrophy Association, mm-hmm. MDA. That would not pay my salary, but would pay a technician and research, so I could start to expand. Mm-hmm. When I started, there was someone that was a little bit more senior that was recruited approximately the same time that I was here in neurology. He was working with dystrophin and dystrophin-related problems, and gene therapy of muscular dystrophy. So he was not as lucky in terms of getting grants. And after, I think, 4 years or so, he had to leave the department because he had no funds.
That's scary.
Yeah, that's scary. But in this particular case, I benefit from it because all his space became mine because we're kind of together. Uh-huh. And a lot of his equipment became mine mm-hmm. also because there was neurology startup mm-hmm. equipment. So, yeah, it was not good for him. But, you know, his bad luck worked in my favor. Even though I had one less colleague to collaborate or talk to, at least. But then, later, maybe, I don't know, 5 years ago or so, I got another R1 from the National Institute of General Medical Science. We can discuss more about the specific projects later. And so I never had much of a problem in terms of bringing my salary mm-hmm. or funding people in the lab. I never had to fire someone because I was out of money. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean that that's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. It's actually likely to happen because, you know, now I have two additional R01s. So I'm very heavily funded now, mm-hmm. I think, with four R01s. I've never had that many.
Are you at four
yeah.
now? Oh, wow. I saw yeah. three on your resume.
Yeah, one I just heard pending. About. It's not active yet.
Yeah, okay. And so you have two others also. You have a...
Yeah, besides the one I mentioned, yeah. I have one that just started from NCI, the National Cancer Institute. And now I just heard that I got one from the National Institute of Neurological Disease and Stroke.
Right. But you have two non-NIH grants also.
That's the Muscular Dystrophy Association, mm-hmm. and I had the one for the National Parkinson Foundation.
Yeah. Yeah.
That kind of expired, but I keep carrying forward because they let me do so.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, I have quite a bit of money for supplies now, so I do not have mm-hmm. to use that money. Mm-hmm. So I was lucky in terms of not having the problem of, you know, not having money. That doesn't mean that the anxiety was not there.
Right.
I have always been very careful with money in all aspects of my life.
Mm-hmm. Let me turn the tape over.